Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems on the island of Maui. They've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now. Become a snack subscriber and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. And use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order. You know what my favorite text is? A waypoint in the Onyx Hunt app to a goblin turkey. The list on the Onyx Hunt app features for chasing turkeys is long, but knowing exact public and private boundaries and land ownership details will help you find more places to hunt, whether that's on public or private. I'll be toting the Hunt app through the spring woods in a few states this year, and I recommend you do the same if you want more turkeys on your table. Also, Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onyxmaps.com/hunt this spring.
I'm sure a lot of you guys remember the old ceremonial hunting tradition of eating the heart out of the first animal you kill. Meat from those organs are among the most nutrient-rich foods on the planet. You can get those same benefits your ancestors craved via convenient daily capsules from Heart and Soil. Find out more at heartandsoil.co. And remember, use code MeatEater for 10% off your purchase.
I could see them spinning full strut. And as I raised up and went to shoot them turkeys, it was boom! And everything got dark.
We've got 8 turkey storytellers stacked like cordwood on our final Turkey Stories episode of 2024. They hail from Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, and Arkansas. The Southeastern Conference in Collegiate Sports has an interesting tagline stating, "It just means more down here." There are passionate and incredible turkey hunters all over this great country. But I've got to say, that SEC tagline fits turkey hunting like a 3-piece custom suit. It sure means a lot down here. On this episode, we've got 3-wheeler wrecks, people getting shot, folks flying around in jets, a turkey walking with a forked stick, and even a voodoo gobbler. I really doubt that you're going to want to miss this one. And hey, I'll be on the Meat Eater live tour starting April 23rd, going all the way through May 5th. Me and Steve Rinella, Giannis, Cal, all the guys, we're going to be hitting Mesa, Arizona, San Diego, Anaheim and Sacramento, California, Salt Lake City, Utah, Boise, Idaho, Missoula, Montana, Spokane, Washington, Portland, Oregon, and Tacoma, Washington. You can buy tickets for those shows now. I hope to see you there. And at some point, we're going to come to the South, so stand by.
And I've got my gun like this right here, and I go to leaning. And about that time, I just tumped over.
My name is Clay Newcomb, and this is the Bear Grease Podcast, where we'll explore things forgotten but relevant. Search for insight in unlikely places, and where we'll tell the story of Americans who live their lives close to the land. Presented by FHF Gear, American-made, purpose-built hunting and fishing gear that's designed to be as rugged as the places we explore. Just this last week, I was in Mississippi turkey hunting with my friend Lake Pickle. We were within hearing distance of 4 gobblers at daylight. One of them darn near in field goal range as he clasped a pine limb in the windless cold twilight. They gobbled good on the roost, but as the dark forest became like a dimly lit room and gradually brightened to the point of being able to discern between tree species, they quit. Almost as if they'd talked it over the evening before, when their dinosaur toes hit the ground, they went silent, tight-beaked, despite the pleading yelp marks that Lake was leaving on their feathers. At 9 a.m., we left, and we went to a new property and made a big loop, yelping from time to time in the mid-morning, all the while listening. most of the hope for our morning was gone. Until, at 10:45, we heard the arrogant gobble of a tom following the sharp staccato of a pileated woodpecker. We closed the distance with no more than 75 quick footsteps when Lake's posture changed and he stuck out his chest, and from deep within erupted the most beautiful spine-tingling four-note barred owl hoot I've ever heard made. I did not know if a barred owl had landed on his shoulder or if on the inside he was one. But after the trill of the final note, a gobble erupted so close it shook our souls, and we melted to the ground like May apples in June. Within seconds, we heard drumming, and soon I saw his shiny black chest feathers and his red head moving towards us. My resolve melted like wax as Lake whispered, "Shoot him." But what he couldn't see is that some limbs, briars, and grass stood between us. But like separated lovers, he was closing the distance. After having a near mental breakdown, rotating my shotgun a full 45 degrees, I squeezed the trigger as he walked away after tucking his wing. And the woods erupted in flailing wing beats. Lake Pickle is not a small man, but he outran me to that turkey and snatched him off the pine straw like he was recovering a fumble. We'd done it. In all my outdoor pursuits, the feeling of calling in and killing a spring gobbler is indescribable. And that's why this week we're celebrating the wild turkey. We're going to come in hot with our first storyteller. You may have heard of him. They call him Yalt Yalt. But his name is David Ellis, and he's from West Point, Mississippi. This is about a wild hunt that he had in Missouri with his good buddy Poe Daddy. Pay attention, because this story takes some quick twists and turns. Here's Yalt Yalt.
So the most, I don't know if you would say it was scared, most wore out, but me and my buddy went up to Missouri. I'd been up there about three times trying to kill him in that national forest. And I always wanted to meet this guy named Eddie Salter. You know, Eddie Salter was the guy that you watched on TV. You saw him on the Saturday mornings, and he had that call sign up when he killed a turkey and he went over and picked it up. He'd go, "Ow!" You know, and that embedded in my head, you know, all these years. And I was like, I said, I want to meet Eddie Salter one day. And so anyway, me and my buddy Poe Daddy, his name's Paul, nickname's Poe Daddy, and he wasn't poor. He's just really cheap. You know, we'd get a hotel with one bed to save $10, you know. So we went up there, and I'd been up there about three times trying to kill him. The mountains, I call them mountains to me, you know, but they steep hills. Finally, I ended up with a guy that had 4,000 acres, one block of land, and through a friend of a friend, he said, "Just come on, I'm loaded with turkeys." Well, the first day, man, we got in there and them hills was just as bad as over at the but they had plenty of birds. You would mess up or a bird leave you over here, he'd hammer over here. And you just go to another one, you know. We finally, one day, we just split up like, "Man, you got birds over here, I got birds over here." But the mountains was just wearing us out, them hills and valleys. And they call them ridge runners for a reason. They just run up down the ridge. We trying to run over them, you know. We wasn't smart enough to figure it out yet, you know. So about 3 days of more thunderstorms. The more ridges was wearing me down. I mean, one ridge took us 5 stops to get to the top of it one day. And so the last day I told Poe Dad, I said, "You know what? I'm done with this." I said, "I'm going back to what I used to do and know how I know how to kill turkeys." Because you know how it is when you hunt with somebody, you just play it differently. You don't move like maybe you should because you got two people. You don't call like maybe you should or not call like you shouldn't. You just play it different. And I told him, I said, "This last day, I said, I'm tired of these thunderstorms. I'm tired of these hills." I said, "When them turkeys hit the ground today, I said, I ain't going to have these boots on. I had a running shoes. I'm going to be like Usain Bolt." I said, "When it's go time, it's go time." I said, "When they hit the ridge running, they're going to run down it." I said, "I'm going to be on the other side." I said, "I'm going to pop up." And I said, "I'm going to bust him." I said, "And we're going home." He said, "Well, go get him, son." So right at daylight, them old owls started getting it going. I I said, all right, Po' Daddy. I said, you just stay right here. I said, I'll be back here in just a sec. They just kept on as it got more and more daylight. About that time, foom, foom, shoo, foom, they hit the side of that ridge, and I hit the other side of that ridge, and I was running down there with that shotgun, and they were just hammering all the way. They knew where they was going, and I knew where they was going, and all they needed to do was pop on the other side of the ridge. And as I run and run and run, as I got to the edge of that ridge, they pitched up and flew. They ain't pitched up and flew the whole time. They've been walking all week, and today they pitched up and flew. And I knew the ridge we was on because we had stopped 5 times the day before on that thing. I said, you know what? I ain't giving up. I shot down in that valley, and I started coming all the way up, and they were still hammering on the next ridge, and it just kept driving me, and I pulled myself to the top, and I got up. I could feel the sweat just running off of me. I was hot. I had a pullover on. I got a hoodie. I'm always wearing a hoodie. I was sweating, and they were just over there just hammering, running away. I got on the other side of that ridge, and I took off, and as I got closer, I could see them spinning full strut, and I seen an old pine top. And that song on was just brown, so I slid up under that pine top. I knew I was going to be about 40 yards. And as I raised up and went to shoot them turkeys, it was boom. And everything got dark. And I knew I didn't pull the trigger. I didn't think I did. But I felt blinded. I felt the pain. I could feel the sweat. And as a little bit of blood just run down to my lip, I could taste it. I have a lot of nosebleeds, so I knew what the blood tasted like. And as I sat there thinking, Lord, am I dead? Did I die? And about that time, I heard, ow! And I took my face mask and the pine straw that's all stubbled in my face, and I pulled it down, and I looked, and I said, that's Eddie Salter. Eddie Salter done shot me in the face. So I laid there, and as that guy walked over there, and he picked up both turkeys. And I don't think you could shoot two turkeys in the state of Missouri at the time, but he did. Now, this wasn't Eddie Salter, but that was in my mind that enabled it. All I heard was the hoot owl. And as I laid there, I was thinking, was I trespassing? Was I not trespassing? And as the guy took his turkeys off, he picked them up by the heads. Where I'm from, he picked them up by the feet, throw them over his shoulder. And as he walked off down through the valley, I got up and wiped the sweat and the rest of the blood off my face. And I limped back down there to my buddy Po' Daddy. It took a little bit, and as I got up there, my buddy Po' Daddy said, he looked at me and, well, did you get him? I said, no, I got shot. That's what I got. Well, you ain't say nothing to him. Say something to him. I didn't know if I was actually trespassing time, but all I could think of was, if I am trespassing, not only did I get shot, I may have to pay $1,000. For. I wasn't finna get shot and pay $1,000. I said, we're going home, son. But in the end, I was not trespassing and I hadn't crossed no fences. But in my mind, I never thought that he was trespassing. So we caught, you know, I just thought I'd automatically, obviously got so zoned in on a turkey that I just lost where I was. Anyway, we called the landowner and come to find out, we found out who actually killed him, and they took the, you know, the DNR took care of it. But he was a fella that lived next door to that 4,000 acres that nobody ever turkey hunted. And very well could have been, you know, I could have lost my life. A lot of things could have happened. Guy did not know he shot me. So he's probably 30 or 40 yards on the other side of those turkeys, and he shot both of them between the two turkeys and the treetop. Saved me from probably losing my eyesight. I had about 8 good stings in the face, you know, where the blood was coming out. So if it wouldn't have been for him killing both turkeys and that treetop, they don't tell how many I would have took.
Wow. That was incredibly scary. And David tells it so funny, it's hard not to chuckle. But the actual trespasser did not know at the time that he'd shot David, who had permission to be there. David did. David never heard what happened to the illegal turkey hunter. That's a wild story. And thank God it wasn't more serious for David. I bet that was a long ride back to Mississippi with no gobbler in the truck. David has a podcast and a YouTube channel titled in his signature Yalt Yalt brand. And I've told you before, these Mississippi turkey hunters are just made different. Our next storyteller is also made different. It's none other than my friend Andy Brown from Western Arkansas. He needs no introduction. He's a Bear Grease regular. I'd never heard this story, but it involves a coat and tie and a major mishap at the moment of truth. Here's Andy.
Anyway, Wayne, one time he calls me, and I had just went to work at the place I work at now, and this was in 1990. He calls me, he said, what time are you getting off? And I said, I'll be off at 5 o'clock. He said, you want to go try to roost a turkey? And I said, sure, I'll go with you. And I'll never forget this. I had a pair of black slacks on, white shirt with a black tie. William, he made us wear ties from Labor Day to Memorial Day. So we always had to wear a tie. So that was our attire, you know. Of course, I was decked out, you know. And so we drive out to board camp, and we go in there to a spot and cross the creek and pull the mountain there. And he had a four-wheel drive Chevrolet pickup that took us thousands of miles turkey hunting. But anyway, we pull in there, and he said, do you want my jacket, camouflage jacket? He said, why don't you take that 16-gauge? He had another shotgun, too. I said, Wayne, I ain't going to need that. I said, I'm just going to walk out here east where I can hear good. He said, well, I'll go west out here. And I said, well, I'm going to go out here east. So I go out there, and of course, by getting out there after 5 o'clock, the sun's starting to go down then. But I had those slacks on, and I didn't want to sit down on the ground in those slacks. And I looked, and there was a little piece of plyboard, I guess a storm had blowed in there, about 16 inches wide. And I took that plyboard, and I just set it down by a tree there and sit down on it. I did wear his camouflage jacket, but I didn't take the gun. So I had black pants, white shirt, camouflage jacket, and a black tie. I didn't have it buttoned. I just sitting there, and, you know. So I sat there, and of course, you know, if you're gobbler turkeys, lots of times will not gobble till you think it's too late to gobble, and that's when they'll gobble. It's after the twilight, everything, when you think that they're not going to do it. But anyway, I was sitting there, and it's starting to get dark. All of a sudden, I heard him coming, and I knew there's no doubt. When, I know you've heard this, but when a gobbler turkey is on a mission, it sounds just like a person walking. It's just crunch, crunch, crunch. And I could hear him coming from a long ways. It was dry. And I look, and here come that big rascal right to me. And he just walks up there at about 20 steps of me. He just walks up the mountain there, right up on top, about 30 yards from me, flies up a tree right on top. And there I sat. So I had to wait till it got completely dark. So I drug back into the truck. Wayne said, where you been? I said, well, I told him about the story. I said, but man, in the morning, I said, we going to get this dude because he's going to go back just exactly like he come in there. You know, he's put his hens to bed, and I said, he's going to go back the other way. So the next morning, we get up extremely early. We go in park. We go around the south side of the mountain, hit an old road, get over on the north side. We're going to get set up, you know. And so we walk a little ways and walk a little ways, and we look at them, and I said, let's go a little further. So we go a little further, and we get out there, and I'm out there, I got my pocket knife, and I'm cutting limbs, building them blinds, you know, and get in where we can hide, you know, and I get all that fixed. And I sit out there, and Wade's right there with me. It starts a little bit. I mean, we could have took a nap. It was so early. But anyway, it starts getting daylight, and I look out there, and I thought, what is that right up? I can see something light covered. And I look out there, and there's that piece of plyboard where I've been sitting. I mean, we are sitting right under that turkey, you know. And I thought, oh, no, about that time he gobbles, just blows our hats off right there. And when we did, he just pitches off on the south side of the mountain. He didn't pitch back off the way he'd come in and went right east. There he went, gobbling. And he went right back around there to what we call Bible Gap. Anyway, I told Wayne, I said, come on, let's go try to kill that dude. We go back around, we come into the gap. By the time we get into the gap, he's kind of off on the south side, off down on, it's pretty open in there. He's down there with some hens. Anyway, we got in there and got stashed, and I put in on him, and he went to gobbling. I mean, he was doing it. And I looked off down there, and here he come up the mountain. He just kept coming. And I could have killed him at 30 yards right in front of me, but he was getting to my left. And just right there was a game trail come up a leg. And don't know why I didn't shoot him down there, but anyway, I'm just going to let him keep it coming. You know, he'd come right on up there. He hit that game trail. This is the way it works. There was another one of them big bull pines there. And all he's got to do, when he walked in behind that pine tree, I just moved my gun to the left of it. I was facing this way, but I had to turn my gun And there's nothing. It's just like this floor here on both sides. There's not even a huckleberry bush. I mean, he's in behind the tree at 15 yards. All he's got to do is just, and he just walks right in. And you know, he's in a walk. And about the, when he gets behind that tree, it just stops. It's called patience a guy should have. You should have a little patience because there's really no way this turkey can get away, hardly, you know. But I'm kind of, you know, my body's this way, and I've got my gun like this right here, and I go to leaning to see if I could, you know, leaning over like that. And about that time, I just tumped over. I just tumped over, and that old turkey run his head up there. And of course, I'm laying on the ground like that, and I just, but the problem was, I shot him too low. I mean, I just, and I jump up, and I run to get him, and of course, he got his legs under me and got his wings under me, and he flew right out through a little old notch in the mountain, and as far as I know, he's still going.
Now, that was a good story, Andy, and I figure that turkey is still flying. A fella could take a few notes on how to kill a turkey from Andy Brown, but also on how to tell a turkey story. The perfect story is just the right mix of details, humor, passion, and know-how. Thanks, Andy. Our next storyteller hails from the Smoky Mountains of Southern Appalachia in Greene County, Tennessee. His name is Clifford Lawing. The first turkey you ever killed in the 1970s was the first turkey ever checked in Greene County. He calls this the story of Big Red. And Big Red ain't a turkey.
Clifford Lawing, I've lived here basically all my life, except I was in the military for a while and worked construction for a couple of years out west around Colorado and around. I'll tell you one about the Big Red. My nephew had got a Big Red Honda three-wheeler. I rode it around my house or in the yard a time or two is all I'd ever rode it. And I was working construction at the time, working at Dola Jarvis up there. I was working for CNC Millwright, working construction, and talking to a boy, and he said, "You've been turkey hunting over the road lately?" And I said, "No." I said, "Hadn't been up there in years." He said, "We've been trying to kill one up there." He told me where he was at, and I said, "Well, that's the area where I killed my first turkey." He said, "We can't call him in." Said he'll get the gobbling. And what they was doing, if he wouldn't come to him, they'd try to get closer, and he'd just go away from them, and they'd follow him. Them old smart toms, they'll take you around and around, you know. So I was at work and got off early that evening. I called my brother, because I didn't have a four-wheel drive to get back in there at the time, and I called him. I said, "I borrowed Brendan's Big Red to go to Pine Creek turkey hunting." He said, "Yeah, I'll come and get it." So I said, "Evening hunt." So I loaded it up in the back of the truck, took it over and dumped it out and started up in there. There's a little road that runs up the backbone of the mountain there. It's kind of steep getting up to it. And like I said, I didn't know much about that Big Red, so I started up there and like riding a motorcycle in the mountains, if it starts rearing up, what do? You throw your feet down. I learned the hard way you don't throw your feet down on one of them Big Reds. Because when I got stopped, the wheels was about in behind my knees there. And like I said, didn't have no reverse on it. And I'm sitting there on that steep bank. I said, "I'm in trouble here." Couldn't get off of it. I finally got it killed. Couldn't get it pushed forward enough. And finally got it. Took me about 5 minutes. I said, I'm in trouble here if nobody's over here. Yeah. Finally got it off of me.
Hold on. It flipped over on
you? It didn't flip over, but it run up my back legs. The wheels.
Describe that to me better.
When it reared up, I threw my legs down. And the rear tires is right there, and they come up my back of my legs.
So it's got you pinned down.
And it had me pinned.
Oh, wow.
And I'm sitting on that steep hill, pinned,
your
with my leg.
On the ground.
Yeah, my knees are on the ground, almost on the ground.
Hands and on the handlebar.
Yeah, and I'm pinned where I can't do anything about it. And I worked there for a while and finally got out of it, luckily. And I eased on up that road, and I had my shotgun. Didn't have back in them days. I just had a rope tied to it and over my shoulder. Eased up through there, and there's a place or two. There was a limb hanging. I'd have to get around that, and I got up there in the field where I'd kill my first turkey. Stopped, got off of it, and walked around there for a while looking for sign, and it was probably about an hour before dark. So I got my call out. I used a mouth call. I got it out, and I cackle real loud over on the next ridge. So I got across this hollow, and I don't know if I can get this done all before dark or not. I stood there. I couldn't stand it no longer. I took off. Got over there and eased up there and found a pretty place to sit down. Had a little level flat in it and went up the ridge. I called and he gobbled right up on the ridge above me. He gobbled every time I called. He gobbled up here, then he come back down here. I said, he's not coming down. And it's getting on down. I'd like the tape said, old Rob Keck said, if you got one to hang up, just turn your head and call a time or two and spit it out and just don't call no more. So I did, and he gobbled. Well, I just sat there, seemed like forever. And I seen a black spot moving on the ridge above me. He'd stop and start turning around and around, strutting. I guess that was the best hunt I ever had. He'd take a few more feet, gobble, turn around and around. My call was laying on the ground. I just sat there and watched him and watched him. It seemed like it took forever for that bird to get to me. And I let him get about 15, 20 yards. He'd just go around and around circle, drum, spit and drum, gobble. I was tore all to pieces. I don't say I kept seeing my shotgun shake. You know, I said, well, I'm finally have to shoot him. So I shot him, got him, got back to the three-wheeler. It was almost dark. I mean, it was getting on down there. So I tied him on the three-wheeler and tied my shotgun back across my shoulder and took off down through there. And it was getting pretty black by then. And I didn't remember the tree hanging across the trail. And my shotgun hooked it. The next thing I knowed, I was eating the ground and the three-wheeler's going down through the woods with my turkey. So I survived that one, got up and got on out of there. I was more careful getting on out of there after that. Just, that was the last time I rode Big Red to the mountains.
That was a good story, Clifford. It's a wonder any outdoorsman survived the 1980s, as much of the backwoods travel was done on Honda Big Red three-wheelers. From the very beginning, they were known as Widowmakers and Death Traps. Gary Believer Newcomb never had a Big Red, but he had a Kawasaki 110 three-wheeler, which was just as dangerous, just not as iconic of a machine. Dad actually bought me a little two-stroke Yamaha Tri-Zinger three-wheeler when I was 4 years old. I still remember tumping that thing over a time or two and once hitting a barbed wire fence. It's a wonder any of us are still alive. If turkeys had three legs, they'd be easy to kill. You could just tip them over on an incline. Ready to win Mother's Day and cement your reputation as the best gift giver in the family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. She'll love looking back on these memories and seeing what you're up to today. Even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep updating mom's frame with new photos, so it's the gift that keeps on giving. And this is not a joke. Juju Newcomb has an Aura frame, and we share photos, and they're incredible. Also, my mother-in-law has one. We have them. They truly are really good, really high quality. The Aura frame is easy to set up. It takes just 2 minutes to set up a frame using the Aura app. It also adjusts the display depending on light levels in the room to maintain the true color of your photos. For real, the digital screen is amazing. Right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame when you use code BEAR, B-E-A-R, BEAR. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code BEAR at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply. Montana Knife Company was founded by Josh Smith, one of the world's most experienced master bladesmiths. He's been making knives for 30 years. Made in the USA and manufactured locally in Montana. The knives come with a multi-generational warranty and free sharpening. Designed, tested, and built by hunters, MKC is a hunting knife company first and foremost. They have the sharpest knives out of the box and the easiest knives to sharpen. And that is the dadgum truth. You better be careful with them when you get them. They are sharp. MKC is a fast-growing company. They just hired their 55th employee and are looking to hire about 50 more in the next year or so. I've carried a lot of these Montana knives, and the one that I like the most is their Speed Goat, which is a lightweight hunting knife, just the right size. MKC knives sell out within minutes of being released, so head over to MontanaKnifeCompany.com. They have new knives for sale every Thursday at 7 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So check their website and sign up for their text and email alerts. That is the best way to find out when they have knives available. Use code BEARGREASE10 for 10% off your first order. Montana Knife Company, working knives for working people. The old timers say that the turkeys start gobbling when the leaves are as big as squirrels' ears and the red buds start popping. And we're about there. And we are there in the South. The Onyx Hunt app is one of my most valuable tools in the spring woods. With tools like coniferous versus deciduous tree distribution layer, you can save time by locating edges or transition areas of mixing habitats from home. Find an area like this with water in close proximity, and more than likely, there will be a goblin turkey nearby. Knowing the exact boundaries of private ground ensures I stay on the right side of the fence, but can easily find public ground to go see if I can't strike a gobbler. If you do get one to sound off, using compass mode and waypoints will help you pinpoint his exact location, allowing you to move in and make the perfect setup to bring him right into your lap. Download the Onyx Hunt app today. You'll be glad you did. Onyx has a special offer for you. Use code BEARGREASE to receive 20% off your membership at onxmaps.com/hunt this spring. Our next story is probably going to surprise you. The mode of transportation isn't a three-wheeler, an old 4x4 pickup, or a mule. It's rather a jet. This is Slade Johnson of Tuscaloosa, Alabama. He's a very serious turkey hunter with a very unique 45 hours of turkey hunting to tell us about. And you're going to need to know that a turkey hunting grand slam is killing the four subspecies of turkeys in the United States. An Osceola, only in Florida, an eastern turkey in the eastern deciduous forest, a Merriam in the western U.S., and the Rio Grande in the southwest. Here's Slade.
I grew up turkey hunting. That was, like I said, that was my passion, passed down to my grandfather and dad since before I could walk. It's my favorite thing to do. Out of all the turkey, and I try not to miss a day of turkey hunting in the spring, but out of all the turkey hunting I've done, probably the most, my favorite trip was, I guess it was 3 years ago now. One of the investors in my company, he's a big outdoorsman, he's a pilot, and he likes to just do challenging, crazy things. And so we had found out that we were just curious, like, hey, wonder what the quickest time anybody's ever completed the Grand Slam. And so we looked it up, and it was actually a friend of ours was one of the guys that did it, and they'd done it in 46 hours, somewhere between 46 and 47 hours. And we're like, oh, we can beat that, or thinking we could at least, you know. And so we're starting to put this big strategy together of like, all right, let's make this a fundraiser for the NWTF. Let's use, you know, swap trips with guys through Trips for Trade. John would fly his plane. He's a pilot, like I said, so that would make things a lot more efficient to get to each of the birds. But our goal was we're going to do this in under 36 hours. And so we were thinking, you know, that'd be really two full days of daylight of hunting. And then we found out that the guys had done it before started the clock on the first gunshot. So at the end of the story, you see that made a difference. So we decided, all right, as soon as we harvest the first bird, the clock starts. When we harvest the last one, it stops. And we'll see if we can break this 46-hour world record. So anyways, we started in Alabama. Thought that was going to be a layup because that's his personal farm. Cover up in birds, very low pressure. And it took us till like 9:30 in the morning to get it done at that farm, which we were like, oh man, this is killing our time. We really thought we needed to kill off the limb this morning. So we kill that bird, we run over to the plane, take off, landing near Orlando in Florida. We hop in a rental car there, we drive to this farm, which is a Trips for Trade guy on the swap, and no pressure on this farm too, hoping that we could get it done. And those birds, again, thought it was going to be a layup, and they whooped us. We got all the way down to the last probably the last 5 minutes of shooting light, and we're like, it's done. We're not going to be able to do this if we don't harvest this bird this evening. And like an answered prayer, these two longbeards come out, not answering calls, not gobbling. They just come walking out into the field, and John was able to get it done there. So we're high-fiving. We're all fired up. So, again, back to the airport. We fly overnight to Kansas. Buddy Casey's there, incredible turkey hunter. He had got permission on a farm for us to hunt a Rio there in Kansas and had roosted them, which so many people involved with this. It was incredible to see. And so that morning, right there, they're set up on this tree. They know where he's roosted, about to get, you know, daybreak's about to happen. And they look over and two guys are poaching coming in from the road. Somebody dropped them off and they're walking in between under the trees the turkeys are roosted in. So they're at this dilemma too of like, do we stop the poachers and confront them? Do we just like hope they don't screw up this hunt? Because we're on the clock. We don't want to screw up the hunt. It's now or never. This is the only birds we've got on this farm. And so they were just like, we'll worry with them after. Hopefully they keep walking. So we don't even know where they ended up going. But the birds woke up, gobbled on the limb, pitched right down, just picture perfect hunt. So now we're on cloud nine. We're, you know, this is daybreak of the second day in Kansas. You know, 6:15, whatever the time is, we've already killed the Rio. So back to the plane. We're in South Dakota by like 11. And so we land in the Badlands. Sean's up there, awesome dude. They got a big Indian reservation property that we could hunt. And by the time we land and walk in there, he's like, I saw a group of birds in this field. You know, we should be on them within an hour. So we had our first setup there in South Dakota. The clock was at 27 hours in. And so that would have obviously been an incredible just time for doing that challenge. But then they just gave us the runaround. We hunted all day. We had six different opportunities on birds. We had misses. We had ran out of, you know, lost shells, just everything you can imagine, just thinking we could not get it done on the Miriam. And so we're getting down to the end of the day and we realize we're not going to be able to do it. So we're defeated. We are like whooped. We're sitting at dinner that night, just like heads in our hands, you know, just like, golly, we put all this effort into trying to do this and we didn't do it. And we're doing the math and we're like, wait, since we didn't kill till 9:15 in Alabama, that gives us 30 minutes of daylight to still be under the world record the next day. But we had a rainstorm coming in. So we're like, there's little hope, but like, it's probably not going to happen. And so sure enough, the rainstorm ended that morning right before daybreak, and it was the most perfect hunt. We're setting up on the edge of this field. I bet you there was 20-plus longbeards gobbling in the trees around us, like just pure big group Miriam fashion. Bird pitches down. I'm calling on this one, and John's up in front of me to shoot, and we can't get him to break the distance. He's just strutting out in the field at distance, and we're like counting the seconds. Like, we need you to come over here. Anyways, finally, he broke and came in close enough to get the shot. John made a great shot. We picked him up, and we ended up harvesting that bird, and we stopped the time. It was, I think, 45 hours and 52 minutes. So we had 8 minutes left to spare for the world record. So that's probably one of the most meaningful hunts I've had. You know, it was a lot of people involved. You got to see every subspecies of turkeys in the U.S., so that was a lot of fun. And then ultimately, as I mentioned earlier, the fundraiser side, I think there was like $25,000 or $26,000 worth of money of people donating that were watching this live on Instagram and everything, donating money to be in the raffle that we were able to donate to NWTF.
I wasn't expecting a jet when Slade started telling me this story. That's pretty wild. I'll be impressed when somebody makes a turkey slam only using a Honda Big Red three-wheeler as their mode of transportation. Slade runs a business called Trips for Trade, where they connect people looking to trade hunts with other people across the country. It's a pretty neat business. Our next storyteller is my friend Dale Craig from Western Arkansas. Dale told one of the best deer stories ever told on this podcast about calling in a buck with a rolling apple. Y'all remember that one? He's a veteran woodsman and a mountain hunter. Here's Dale with a short story about a gobbler putting the voodoo on him and his buddy Travis.
One thing me and Travis got into one time, decided we was going to work the turkeys over, you know, kill us one. We'd been all over the country. It was just two or three days before the season was over with, and I pull up here to the house, and I hear this turkey gobbling over here just east of my house. It's right at dark. I called Travis up. I said, hey. I said, I just roosted a turkey. He said, where at? I said, right here. I'm standing right here in the yard, and I said, it's over here east of the house. We'd been all over the the mountains, everywhere, trying to kill. We hadn't, neither one of us had killed a turkey. And he said, well, how we get in there to it? You know, and I told him where we was going to go the next morning. So we met up way before daylight, parked in a neighbor's hay meadow. We slipped off up there on the edge of that ridge. And it's starting to get light, called. Boy, this turkey just gobbled and just set in, just tearing the woods up. I told Travis, I said, we need to get, you know, get up here and get set up. I said, that turkey's, he'll come in just a little bit. So we eased on up on the ridge, got up there, and we got set up. Travis, he'd call for a little bit, and that turkey just gobble, gobble, gobble. I tried with my call, just kept a gobbling right there in that same place. So we decided he had some hens with him. So we just started easing that way, being real quiet. And every once in a while, that old turkey gobble. So we got set up again. We called. That dude just gobble, gobble, gobble right there in that same place. Wouldn't come. We sat there and listened to that thing forever. And I mean, every time you called, he just cut you off. We decided we was going to sneak off down there and try to put the ambush on him, you know. We got to slipping off down there, slipping on down the ridge there, and got on off the side of it. Then I heard a rooster crow. We looked at one another, and then we decided that turkey was in a pen down there. I didn't know that house was back in there. I hadn't been back in that country in years. I used to coon on all in there. This old gobbler, we slipped on down there where we could see that old gobbler. You could see him down there in that pen. You could hit that call. That dude just gobble, gobble, gobble. He's in that pen by himself with a bunch of chickens. But that, I didn't even know that house when it was built. But anyway, we was going to ambush that old turkey, and he kind of put the voodoo on us.
The old pen turkey story. Any bona fide turkey hunter should have sniffed that one out after Dale's opening line. But I walked into it like an ox to slaughter. Or like a 1980s middle class man walking into a Honda dealership and buying a Big Red. What got me was that it was by Dale's house. And I knew that he would have known what was going on near his own land. I didn't see the pen turkey coming. Anyway, good story, Dale. Our next story is from the mountains of East Tennessee, told by a man named Kevin Laws. He's a humble fella with a string of turkey spurs darn near long enough to wrap around a Volkswagen. Here's Kevin.
When I started out turkey hunting, it's probably been about 25 years ago, I guess, because I always kept beagles and coon dogs and bear dogs, and I used to didn't like nothing if it didn't have a dog involved in it. I mean, that's all I'd ever done was bear hunted and rabbit hunted and coon hunted. I wasn't interested in no turkey. I finally decided there that I would give it a try. The first year, I didn't kill no turkey. And then, me and my brother went together, and he killed a big gobbler early that morning, and there was another one with it, and it run past me. And I killed it, and it had two beards. That was my first turkey that I'd ever killed. After that, I just got to hunting and learning as I went. But they's a lot better turkey hunters than I am around here. I mean, there's some good turkey hunters in this part of the country. I remember one time I had been up in the mountains, and I had this turkey up there, and I'd got the calling on it, and I mean, he was doing some gobbling, and my brother was with me that day. I finally got him called in, and when he came around kindly behind me, and my brother was on this other side over here, and so I just kind of eased around with my shotgun there and got me a good bead on him, and when I shot, he left out. I missed him. I mean, He was gone, son. I missed him. That was about, I don't know how long I've been hunting, but I still haven't been hunting a long time then. And we waited 2 or 3 days and went back, and we called him there again, and we got him to gobbling, and he come in, and then he left back out, went way down through a holler there. Must have been Seemed like a half mile. I don't know if it was or not, but it was a pretty good piece. And I thought, well, he's gone. I mean, you know. And this was of evening. And I told my brother, I said, let's give him one more call and see what happens. And so I let out a big cackle, or I had a mouth call, and I let out a big cackle. Man, he gobbled down in there, and a few minutes, he come on, he was still gobbling, and my brother said, he's coming. So I just sat there and waited for him, and he came up there and jumped up on a big log there and stood like he was pretty brave, you know, whatever. So I blowed him off the log there, and that was pretty good hunt right there. And then it wasn't but a few days later, it was getting closer to the end of season, I guess. And we went back to the mountains again there, and my brother was with me again there too. And I liked hunting the mountains because sometimes you can call and they may be there in 10 or 15 minutes, and then sometimes it may be 2 hours. And I got up there and we called, and he was one gobbled about three ridges over. And we called a few more times. My brother sat over here on the left side of me, and I was watching for the turkey to come up through here. And, I mean, it wasn't, I'd say it was less than 10 minutes. And, I mean, he was over like three ridges. And, man, he was there, and all of a sudden I hear my brother shoot, you know, and he's killed the turkey. But them some fun hunts right there. I like him.
Those were good stories, Kevin. I like those kind of hunts, too. Our next storyteller is also from East Tennessee near Greenville. His name is Chris Hobson, and he's going to tell us about chasing one the hard way with a bow, with no blind and no decoys, and no Honda Big Red.
Well, my name is Chris Hobson. I'm from Greenville, Tennessee. I guess I got started briefly turkey hunting back when I was a kid, when there was hardly any turkeys around, you know. But that was just the early stages, and didn't get really involved big with it until probably late 80s, you know, early 90s. Of course, when I was a kid, I mean, it's like you very rarely ever seen a turkey, you know. And it's like seeing a bobcat, you know, you're just really surprised to see one. I've had some really good times in the turkey woods and some good success, and there's a lot better turkey hunters than I am. I don't really believe in luck, but I've been fortunate enough to, you know, kill my share of turkeys. But this one is it's right there around where I live at home. I had decided I was just going to dedicate half the season to bow hunting turkeys. There was a particular gobbler hanging around there around the house, and I picked the wrong one to bow hunt after I got to chasing him. So because we live on a farm there, and he would get out in a big pasture field. It was probably, I don't know, it's probably 15 acres. And every morning I'd be down there, and I'd know exactly where he was roosted and try to set up. And when I said I was dedicating half the season to bow hunting, I meant with no ground blind or anything. I just put a ghillie suit on and just wanted to hunt it, you know, just out of the woods and try to blend in. Wasn't using any decoys, and which is it's very hard to do. Yeah. Well, this particular turkey, I picked the wrong one to bow hunt because he would come out when he would come off the roost, he would go right in the middle of the pasture field, and he would stand there for hours, just going back and forth, just strutting. You know, he'd have a couple hens with him, but he was very stubborn, and I probably hunted that turkey for a week and a half. I got really close a few times, but, you know, bow hunting is, it's a game of yards and feet most of the time. He finally made a mistake. I got up one morning before daylight, and he was roosted in a different spot that morning. He flew out in the edge of the pasture field that morning, and then he scurried around some of the other fields there, and I would just back off and, you know, go back behind the ridge, you know, get behind him and where he couldn't see me, and try to set up in front of him, you know. I tried all different types of calls, you know, diaphragms, and wasn't using any decoys. That's pretty hard to do, especially if you got one stubborn like that. There was a little pond there, and he went toward the little pond, and there were some old blow down trees down there, and I got in behind that those trees, and I just sat. I had caught him crossing. There was a bottom there, and he was coming down that bottom sometimes in, you know, late morning. I got set up over there on one of those blown down trees, and there was a cedar tree or something there, and I just, you know, skirted up behind it, and I probably shot him at 12, 13 yards. I had to draw before he got there, you know, and I had to, you know, I had to wait. Of course, I had a low poundage bow because it don't take a whole lot of poundage to kill a turkey with a bow, but made a really good shot on him. And I tell a lot of people, I like to bow hunt them, but there's just something about a shotgun, you know, it's because there's so, you know, a turkey's vitals are so small. You know, when you're bow hunting a turkey, I mean, it's, you know, you've got to be precise on your shot placement, and I just did everything just lined up that day to, you know, for it to happen. You know, I'm just a bow hunter at heart. I just love to bow hunt, but I like to shotgun hunt them too. You know, I don't bow hunt them a whole lot now, but because I'm just taking my nephew and my daughter a lot now. That's, you know, there's a lot of those hunts that stands out that's really special to me with my daughter and my nephew. I have to give them credit. They hung in there pretty good and killed some pretty tough turkeys too.
Chasing a turkey with a bow without a blind or decoys is as difficult a turkey hunt as there is, period. I've just started to notice that some turkey hunters are giving people a hard time for killing turkeys out of blinds. I didn't realize we were doing that, like giving people a hard time about this. It's no doubt easier when you're in a blind, and I don't really have a dog in the fight. I've never killed a turkey out of a blind, but it's interesting that we're ribbing people about a method to take. Anyway, just an observation. Good job, Chris. Thank you for the story. Our next story is being told in the Mississippi Wildlife Heritage Museum in Leland, Mississippi. Bill Baird is from Indianola and is a long, long time turkey man. I'm just going to let these two stories that he's about to tell us unfold on their own without much foreshadowing. But I figured the first story should be called The Forked Stick.
My name's Bill Baird. I'm from Indianola, Mississippi. I guess if I remember the first turkey hunt I went on with my father, I was about 12 years old, had a 16-gauge Browning, and I think the first time that we went, he set me off by myself, and I missed a turkey. And then we went on that afternoon to kill one, so that kind of got me started. Kids nowadays start hunting when they're 5, 6, 7 years old, but most of the older men back in those days, we needed to be about 12 years old to be able to handle a gun to where we could hunt. So I guess that's when I started turkey hunting. Well, you know, I enjoy all hunting, but I don't know, there's something about a turkey. When you fool with a turkey in the fall, you see them and they're really dumb. You know, they'll stand there and look at you on the side of the road. But when you start hunting a big old turkey, a three or four or five year old turkey, he's been through several seasons and he's wised up. When you get an old turkey and you trick him, you've really done something. You know, you said something about that earlier about a favorite hunt. There's so many of them that I can remember, but one particular time that actually Roy and a friend of ours from Indianola went to Illinois. We go to Illinois every year, been doing it for years and hunt with the family up there, but we could kill two turkeys and I killed one day and one the next day. Probably two of my best turkeys. And the first one kind of, it wasn't mountainous, but it was hills pretty high, and the turkeys would kind of roost right off the top of the ridges. And I heard one gobble and got up there that morning, and it was a fence, and the fence was a line, so I couldn't go on the other side of the fence. Well, the turkey was on the other side of the fence, so I'd call and he'd gobble, and I'd wait and I'd call and he'd gobble. Finally, I just figured out, you know, I'm gonna just be silent and make him come look for me. Well, I see him coming through the woods, and he's limping. And he's just walking along limping like this. He kind of got one wing down. I said, something's wrong with that turkey. Well, he got up to the fence. And right when he got to the fence, I saw him kind of bend down and do something. And he came up on the other side of the fence, and he looked up real tall, and he kept walking on towards me. Big old beard, old turkey, but he was messed up in one foot. We finally got close enough, and I spoke to him, good morning. shot him, went over there and got him, and under his right wing, he had a forked stick that he was walking along using that stick as a crutch. I don't know what I ever did with a stick. I should have kept it, I guess.
Wait a minute, Mr. Bill. What? Okay.
But he was a big old turkey, and he did have a gimped up foot. Now, that's, I told that story, and believe it or not, how many folks will believe it for a little bit? I almost got you there. But he was one of the bigger ones. And the next morning, we went to another ridge. My friend and I from Indianola went to another ridge. And the first time I messed up my knee, we were walking along, and I stepped over a log, and I tripped, and I fell. The turkey was gobbling, and he was down in the bottom. And my friend said, "Well, you just stay here. I'm going to go on, and I'll shoot the turkey." I said, "No, no, it's my turn." So we keep going, and I'm hobbling along. Finally, we get up there, and we peep over a ridge down there, and we see the gobbler down there with two hens, and he's just strutting. He won't gobble. He's just strutting with those two hens. And the hens were dusting. So we sit down, get ready, and we call, and I call, and he'd look up. Every now and then, he'd gobble. The more we called, we got a turkey coming from behind us, and he came up there. And my friend Ed said, "Well, let me shoot this one." I said, "Nope." And I had to literally put my foot on his gun. I said, "No, we're going to kill this turkey down here. He's bigger." So he was kept trying to slide his gun out, and he was messing with me, and I'd call. And finally, this old gobbler came behind us, and he started gobbling just right at us. Well, the old big turkey down there, you know, it got him wise, so here he comes. Anyway, he runs up the hill. Long story short, I shoot him in my butt, and my knee is hurt, so I can't run. And my buddy runs down there and puts his foot on his head, and he says, "You lucky sucker, this is the biggest one you'll ever kill." And it probably was. I think, I don't remember what he weighed, but he had 1 15/16 spurs. Those two particular hunts that I went on day back to back like that, I'll always remember that, and I always kind of tell that story at the beginning to kind of get off on a good track, you know. Yeah.
When I first met Mr. Bill, he didn't strike me as a comedian, so the forked stick caught me off guard for a bit. Then when he had to put his foot on his buddy's gun so he wouldn't shoot the smaller turkey so they could get the big one, I then realized I was dealing with a man of rare prowess and wit. Hat tip to Mr. Bill. Great stories. Our final storyteller, the one wrapping this thing up, is once again my friend Russ Arthur from Cleveland, Tennessee. He told the story on the last episode of finding the journals of his father on the day of his father's funeral. On the first page he opened up to, he found the story his father had written about Russ's first turkey hunt when he was just a boy. It was a great story. Well, here's another one about Russ's father.
We had a special bond with the turkey hunting, and one which, when he did pass, I realized that I had something really special. And a lot of friends, some of which you've met today, that reminded me through those hard times how lucky I was to have that level of a bond with a father. And it was truly special. And, you know, I know it's, I've got a grandson now. Took him on his first turkey hunt last year. He was 7, carried a little 410. And he sat there, and I've never been so proud of my life. He didn't kill a turkey, but we had a hen come in, and she was looking for us, and she looked for us for 15 minutes. I mean, she was panking and popping and looking and just raising all kind of cuss to try to find us, and he never blinked, never moved. And as soon as she walked off, he took his head in that office and says, "Poppy, I wished I could have shot it." And I thought, you know, hopefully I can pass some of this down that got passed down to me. But he and I shared a special bond. There was having to understand the mountains, and you understand them. And sometimes you can get really remote in the wilderness area. And I was about probably 5 miles from the closest road. It was on up in the day. It was a pretty day, and I was more or less just hiking, scouting, enjoying the day, and I heard a turkey gobble. I got my map out, made sure where it was at. You drop off the wrong drainage, you can get in a bad way. Figured out where it was at, side-hilled around, crossed a creek, crossed another creek, pulled up on a ridge, and I looked and I saw this slow rolling little flat, and I thought, if I can make it to that flat, I believe that turkey will come to that flat. There was a little saddle on both sides, and it appeared to be a spring head. And I'd never been there. Been all over that place, but never been to this actual place. No trail, no road. And I saw a huge hickory tree. Thought, if I can make it to that hickory tree, I can kill that turkey. So I eased around through there, and I called up the turkey and killed it. And just was really tickled. Couldn't wait to get out and tell Dad. Of course, this is before cell phones. I come out, and I was living fairly close then and working for the Forest Service then. And I called him as soon as I got home. I said, you're never going to believe where I killed a turkey. And he said, where? And I described it to him. And I said, the funny thing about it is, I said, we're going to have to go back in there. He said, why? I said, well, I got so excited that I've got this habit. If I'm going to be hunting in the backcountry and I'm got a turkey I'm working and I've got a sling on my gun, I'll take it off. I don't want that extra movement in that gun. So I had taken my old leather sling off and I'd rolled it up and put it next to that tree and covered it up. I said, I left my sling. I got so excited, I come out of there and walked all the way out of there, and I got halfway out before I realized I left my sling, so we're going to have to go back in there. Next day, I had to work the next day. I come home from work, and when I come home from work, there on my back door was a turkey feather, and all it said was, call me. Oh, man, my sling was there. So I called Dad, and I said, what's going on? He said, you'll never believe this, but he said, it's such a pretty day. He said, I thought I'd go back in there, try to find your sling. And he said, I kind of went in a different way, and about 11 o'clock, I heard a turkey, and I coursed it, and I got my map out, and I pulled up there, and I saw this saddle, and I thought, well, if I could get to that hickory tree. And he walked, and he sat down right at the same tree and killed that turkey the very next day. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
That truly is an incredible story. Jim and Russ's knowledge of the land and how to communicate before we had Onyx pins on our phone is pretty wild. Great story, Russ. Thank you. I hope you've enjoyed these stories, and I know that I sure enjoyed meeting all these folks face to face. We've really got something to celebrate in the wild turkey. Be safe this year. Best of luck in the turkey woods, and I can't thank you enough for listening to Bear Grease. I'll see all you Western folks on the live tour soon, and I really hope to convince these meat eater boys to come to the South sometime soon. I hope you have a great turkey season. Maui Nui is on a mission to help balance axis deer populations for the good of our environment, communities, and food systems on the island of Maui. They've shared over 126,000 pounds of nutrient-dense protein with the Maui community. Secure your spot now, become a snack subscriber, and join in helping to build more resilient food and ecosystems on Maui. Visit MauiNuiVenison.com. That's MauiNuiVenison.com. And use promo code BEAR for 20% off your first order. This show is sponsored in part by BetterHelp. Around New Year's, we get obsessed with how to change ourselves instead of just expanding on what we've already done right. Maybe you finally organized one part of your space and you want to tackle another. Or maybe you're taking your supplements every morning and now you actually want to eat breakfast. In the last year, I've been more diligent about going to the gym on a regimented schedule, and it's made a lot of difference in my life. Therapy helps you find your strengths so that you can ditch the extreme resolutions and make changes that really stick. Therapy is helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. It empowers you to be the best version of yourself. It isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Celebrate the progress you've already made. Visit BetterHelp.com/grease today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp.com/grease.